You're listening to Justice Radio on WMPG with Rob Ruffner from the Maine Engine Defense Center. And today we're speaking with Jonathan Rapping from Gideon's Promise. We're going to talk about values and culture and what that means in the context of public defense, public defenders, and transforming the system. John, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and Gideon's Promise?
Sure, Rob. Happy to. Great to be here with you. And let me start by saying I admire what you're doing in Maine. And I think, the work you're doing to build a professional public defender office is badly needed, not just in Maine, but all across the country. So, as you said, my name is John Rapping. I am the co-founder of Gideon's Promise. I founded it along with my wife, and I'll tell you a little bit about her a little later. I also am a faculty member at Atlanta's John Marshall Law School, where I direct our criminal justice certificate program and am the founding director of our Criminal and Civil Justice Institute. And I'll tell you a little bit about how Gideon's Promise came to be. So I started my career as a public defender in Washington, D.C., at the D.C. Public Defender Service, which is really a model public defender office, not because the lawyers are better lawyers coming in than lawyers in public defender offices across the country, but because they come into an office that has a culture and a spirit and a level of resources that allow the lawyers there to give every client what they deserve. I think I took that for granted. I was there for 10 years. When I left, I was the training director. Every lawyer that came to that office went through 8 weeks of training before they even got a client. He had caseloads. I think when I left, I was doing serious felonies. I probably had about 20 cases. And when I moved to Georgia and I told people that I had 20 cases, they said, "Wow, what did you do Tuesday through Friday?" Like they couldn't believe I only had 20 cases. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I had 20 cases, but I was working 7 days a week. I was working 70 to 80 hours a week, but I was able to give every person everything they deserved. There was a culture and a level of expectation about what the people we served deserved that I sort of took for granted when I was in D.C. And then in 2004, I was invited to Georgia to become the first training director for its new statewide public defender system. I spent a couple years there before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. I then went to New Orleans to be part of the leadership team to help build the public defender office there in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. I did some work in Alabama and Mississippi. And I started meeting all of these young, smart, passionate public defenders who came out of law school wanting to change the world. And they went into systems that just beat the spirit out of them. And they didn't have training. They didn't have support. And within 2-3 years, they would either quit or, even worse, start to become shaped by a culture of indifference, start to become resigned to that status quo and start to be part of the problem, start to be lawyers who were okay processing human beings through the system. And so Gideon's Promise really was started as an organization to not just provide training and skills to public defenders, but to give them a supportive community, to give them strategies to live their values in systems that were hostile to their values, and to develop them into tomorrow's leaders. That was really the origin of Gideon's Promise.
And you mentioned that your wife was part of that journey to Gideon's Promise coming into existence. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so as I said, I was a public defender when when Gideon's Promise started. My wife is not a lawyer. My wife's experience with the criminal justice system was quite different. My wife was an educator when we started Gideon's Promise, but she was also the child of an incarcerated parent. Her father was locked up when she was 5 years old for crimes he committed years earlier. By the time he was locked up, he had turned his life around. He became a small business owner. He was married to my wife's mother, had three beautiful children. My wife, Illy, was 5 years old. She was the oldest at the time. Her mother, pregnant with a fourth child, her baby brother. And her father was arrested, charged with crimes he committed years earlier, and given a public defender. And that public defender never told the story of her father. And without his story, without his humanity being understood, he was processed through that system in upstate New York and sentenced, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years in Attica. And so he spent 10 years, formative years of Illy's life, incarcerated, and she grew up knowing her father from behind bars. She hated public defenders because of her experience watching what happened with her father. And what she said to me that I think always resonated with me, and in many ways is at the heart of the work we do at Gideon's Promise. She said, "You know what was even harder than growing up getting to know my father from behind bars was coming to the realization that the people I love don't matter." Every man in her life had been impacted by the criminal legal system. And it dawned on me that this 5-year-old child learned that lesson, that the people she loved didn't matter, from a public defender. The public defender was the only person her family had contact with. The public defender was her family's connection to the entire criminal justice system. And I am sure that that lawyer who represented her father came out of law school wanting to be a public defender for the reason that many of your listeners want to be public defenders. They want to help people. But over time, the system he was in shaped him into someone who not only wasn't aware of how his indifference impacted the man that stood next to him, but how his indifference impacted a 5-year-old girl, her siblings, her family, her community. And that experience really cemented for me that as public defenders, we don't just serve the people standing next to us in court. We serve children and families and communities. The work is so much more important than just serving the people we're charged to represent, although that alone is critically important. Public defenders are lawyers that ultimately their work impacts entire communities.
You talked a little bit about the transformation of the well-intended new attorney coming out and how the system and then the where they are in that system, their who's around them in that system, their office, can change, metamorphosize, what was intended to become a beautiful butterfly into something else, and the student doesn't even know. Or the new lawyer doesn't even know or recognize sort of what's going on. And that sounds like, the sort of the absence of the values and culture that we would hope exist for a new attorneys and in a defender office. Is that what you're referring to when they're shaped by the system like that, when they come out, is sort of how that sort of culture, the wrong culture and values, can impact that?
No, I think that's exactly right. So I'll tell you, going back to my days with the DC Public Defender Service, that was an office where while we had significantly more resources than many other offices, and the organization had independence, it had the independence to make decisions that were in the best interests of the people we served. I think what I didn't truly appreciate was that more than anything, it had an office culture. It had a client-centered ethos. The lawyers in that office were fiercely client-centered, and you could feel it when you walked into the office. People loved the folks that they represented. They respected them as people. They wanted to ensure that they had dignity, that their priorities were respected, that their voices were lifted up and amplified in the system. And when I moved to Georgia and I really started seeing lawyers who oftentimes valued pleasing judges more than serving people, maybe valued getting along with funders, whoever their funders were, over serving families. I think what I came to understand the idea of culture because I think when I first moved to the South and started doing this work, I started reading a lot about the problems in indigent defense. And I think everything I was reading, the problems really fell into two buckets. There were resource problems, there wasn't enough money. And there were structural problems. A lot of public defenders didn't have independence. They were appointed by judges or county commissioners who, if they fought too hard, they could lose their jobs. And then when I started working in Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, I really started to see the cultural problem. And so let me tell you a story or two that I think illustrate it. And I know you will have far more than 28 minutes. You'll figure out what the best 28 minutes are. But one of my first experiences when I moved to Georgia, Rob, I was the training director. The Georgia statewide system launched January 1st, 2005. That January, we did our first training program for all of the public defenders in Georgia, 400 public defenders, new public defenders, the chief public defenders who were charged with ushering in reform. And one of the sessions we did was a sessions on basic motions practice. And it was just a session on sort of litigating Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment motions, the kind of motions that I literally filed in every case I had as a public defender. And at the end of the session, one of the new chief defenders, one of these leaders who was charged with making reform a reality, approached me and said, "You know, Rap," everyone calls me Rap. He said, "You know, Rap, I really liked that session, but we can't do that where I come from." I said, "What do you mean you can't do that?" He said, "Yeah, we can't do that where I practice." I said, No, you can do it, I assure you. It's federal constitutional law. It applies in Georgia." He said, No, you don't understand." He said, "When we file motions, our judges get upset." That was my introduction to culture. And I started to realize, I started to do research and I read about organizational culture. And what I started to understand was that for scholars who study organizations, and this is mostly in the business context, what they understand is that the thing that most determines whether an organization succeeds or fails is culture. And no one in criminal justice was talking about culture. There was no one writing about culture. And it became clear to me as I read about culture, culture was really just a group of people collectively living a set of values that they embraced and internalized to the point that they weren't even conscious of it. It's the way things are done. And I think, as you said, Rob, what I saw in indigent defense were values inconsistent with justice, inconsistent with serving people, They were judge-centered values versus client-centered values. There were values on moving cases quickly versus ensuring that no stone was left unturned, ensuring that justice was done. And so really, I think our work at Gideon's Promise, as much as anything, is culture work. It's about infusing values, client-centered values, justice-centered values, into everything we do, from who we recruit, to how we train, to how we supervise and mentor, and to how we develop leaders and teach emerging leaders to make values-driven leadership decisions. All of that is part of a process designed to ultimately transform culture in the public defender office, and ultimately to develop offices that can push systems to start to transform the culture by transforming the corrupted values that drive and shape those systems.
You're listening to Justice Radio with Rob Ruffner, and again, we're speaking with John Rapping, from the founder of Gideon's Promise. And we're talking about values and culture and how important they are in a public defender system and in public defender offices. John, you talked about culture, some in values as well. Let's, in this next section, maybe talk about how or what you mean by values and culture and how they relate to each other and how they drive each other. Because I remember from the training that I received through Gideon's Promise, when you use them and when Gideon's Promise talks about them, they mean them in a certain way and in a certain relationship. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, so I'll give you an example. At Gideon's Promise, when we talk about client-centered values, I think there really are sort of four buckets, four value sets that we distinctly talk about. The first is duty of loyalty, loyalty to the people we represent. I think many of the cultures, the cultures I was seeing when I moved to the South, there were examples of loyalty to judges, wanting to please judges, even if conduct hurt the client's case. That was an absence of the value of loyalty to the client, judge-centered, courts rather than client-centered courts. So that was one value. Loyalty was to the client over everyone else in the system. A second value was dignity, respecting the priorities of the people we serve. Time and time again, I saw lawyers who felt like they knew better than the people they represented what choices their clients should make. And if the client made a choice that the lawyer thought was wrong, the lawyer would chalk that up to the client, being stupid or not understanding, instead of realizing that our priorities are a function of our experiences. And we can't assume that what we think is most important is what's most important to the people we serve. We don't know what else is going on in people's lives. But what we teach our lawyers is that when we represent someone, the case belongs to them. We have an obligation to make sure they understand what they're charged with, what their different choices are, what the ramifications are of each choice. We have a duty to think through with them their priorities. What's important to them is keeping their living arrangement is important, is making sure they can maintain their employment. Do they have immigration consequences? What's important to them? But ultimately, then letting them make the decision, dignity. And time again, I was seeing lawyers who were twisting clients' arms to do things that the lawyer thought was best. Third value is preparation, the duty to make sure that we are investigating, doing legal research, being prepared. Again, I saw plenty of examples of lawyers who would meet clients on day one and think they knew the best course of action. They'd read a police report and say, this case should be a plea, right? There's no way any lawyer could know if a case should be a plea before they've done all the work that needs to be done to really assess the credibility of witnesses, what evidence is out there that wasn't shared in the police report. So duty to be prepared. And the final value is communication, the duty to meet with clients, to have conversations, to make sure we understand what they want out of the representation, to make sure they understand everything that we know from our research and our investigation. And oftentimes that communication wasn't happening. So when we talk about culture and values, we are recruiting lawyers who share the values of loyalty to the client, respecting the dignity of the client, understanding the importance of being prepared and knowledgeable and thorough, and understand the importance of communicating. We weave those values into all of our training, and our training not only teaches skills, we often will use examples of how the system will pressure lawyers to fall short of those values and help the lawyers think about strategies to live those values in systems that are hostile to them. And then, after training, as the lawyers go into the real world and they actually run into challenges that threaten their ability to live those values, we have mentors who are helping them think about how to live those values in real time. So, in that sense, we are trying to infuse the lawyer and ultimately the office with a set of values that will create a completely different culture, that will transform a culture that often doesn't serve the people that public defenders represent.
And when you talk about sort of recruiting lawyers who believe in these values, that share these values, sorry, I think that's the important word, share these values. It's not just the new hires, the new lawyers, depending on what system it is in and how that system is structured. It's the leaders and management level as well, identifying, in ensuring it's important to ensure that all levels of the office of the organization share those values down to non-lawyers. It's not down to,
Absolutely.
including, not down to, because they're
That's
very
exactly
often more important than we are, including the non-lawyers, including investigators, paralegals, support staff, and even people who have access to your office, if they're, if they're cleaning up, so that they share, if things are found, they understand I'm working in a place where I got to make sure that this gets to the attention of the people because it's about helping other people and things like that. How would you describe how the chicken and the egg of culture and values, is it that values, the culture is value driven, or is it a loop where the values drive the culture and then the culture supports and then reinforces and develops and strengthens the values. How do you view it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that culture is powerful, and an individual. I use the metaphor of a mighty stream. Think of a white water river with a powerful current. That current is culture. You can jump in that water and be determined to swim against that current. And you can do that for a while, but only for so long. And after a while, your arms will get tired, and you will either get out of the water or you will go along with the current. You'll go with the flow. That current is culture. An individual with a value set inconsistent with the culture ultimately isn't going to change the culture. The culture is going to change them. But if you want to change culture, you have to infuse the organization with a collection of people who are living a certain set of values. And when everyone in the organization is living those values, the culture starts to shift. So, to your question, Rob, as we bring more people in who share the organizational values and live those values, those individuals will reinforce the culture and the culture will get stronger. If you bring in someone whose values are inconsistent with the culture, they won't last. But if you have enough people coming in who have values inconsistent with culture, they can start to shape the culture around the edges. I think our work in public defense in places where the culture has been corrupted by systems that value processing and efficiency and speed is to very consciously infuse the system with people that have the right values and support them until they can start to chip away at the existing culture, ultimately transforming it.
Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time when we continue the conversation with John Rapping about values and culture, as well as Gideon's Promise and how that organization came into being and the roadblocks it may have faced and its mission and how that relates back to the conversation we had today about values and culture. Also, a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode of our series.